is for What's Universe Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iraqi authorities said their troops have retaken about a third of western Mosul in an offensive that began less than a month ago. U.S. Special Envoy to the Global Coalition to Counter the Islamic State, Brett McGurk, speaking in Baghdad, said insurgent fighters are trapped. Many left in Mosul, he said, will die. He also praised the U.S. air campaign in support of the Iraqis.
This air campaign is the most precise air campaign in history, and it has been relentless. We have killed 180 leaders from ISIS, including nearly all of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's deputies, and we're continuing to kill these leaders every day.
Washington Institute for Near East Policy Distinguished Fellow, former Ambassador James Jeffries, said the news could hardly be better. As for how many IS fighters are left in Mosul?
Estimates that I saw over the last couple of days say as many as 5,000, but it could be well less than that. Certainly, I would say that's the highest number. And they're surrounded by about 90,000 troops at this point.
Federal police and rapid response units said they've entered the Bab el-Tob area of the old city with its narrow streets, making the use of armor difficult. But one Iraqi commander said IS militants have lost fighting power, their resolve has weakened, and they've begun losing command and control. In Syria, dozens were killed in a pair of suicide bombings in Damascus Saturday, claimed on Sunday by an al-Qaeda affiliate alliance known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. The targets appeared to be Iraqi Shia Muslim pilgrims. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said several pro-government fighters were also killed. Hundreds of Somali soldiers went on strike Sunday, blocking roads, forcing businesses to close over unpaid salaries. Somalia's new president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, was sworn in last month, promising both to pay the soldiers and crush the al-Shabaab insurgency. This is VOA News. The war of words is heating up between European countries and Turkey.
Benim bakanıma, Dışişleri bakanıma.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Sunday the West is showing its real face in denying involvement of his ministers in rallies with Turkish immigrants. He denounced what he called fascist pressures and a resurgence of Nazism. The Turkish leader warned the Netherlands would pay a price for expelling a Turkish official from taking part in the rallies, backing next month's constitutional referendum that would give him sweeping new powers. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte regretted the war of words.
We are absolutely willing to de-escalate, but of course these utterings of the President of the Turkish Republic do not help, and they are completely unacceptable.
Ankara barred the Dutch ambassador from returning to Turkey while Turkish officials sealed off the Dutch embassy in Ankara. South Korea's ousted former president Park Geun-hye left the official residence, the Blue House, Sunday after the Constitutional Court issued a verdict Friday removing her over a corruption scandal. In a statement, she reaffirmed her innocence and said the truth will come out while expressing gratitude to her supporters. The court also removed Ms. Park's presidential immunity to criminal indictment. A Jordanian soldier, Ahmed Dakamsa, who killed seven Israeli schoolgirls in 1997, was freed Sunday after serving 20 years in prison. His mother, Kamla, said she's happy. She praised Allah. But for an Israeli survivor of the shooting, Karen Mizrahi, Dakamsa didn't serve enough time in prison for the crime, she said. He should have been sentenced to a longer term. He would have faced the death penalty, but he was judged mentally unstable. After the shooting, Jordan's King Hussein personally apologized to the families of the victims. South Africa is considering plans to allow the domestic trade and limited export of rhino horns for personal use. Critics argue any exported horns would be hard to monitor and could end up on the commercial market despite a global ban. Domestic trade was banned in 2009. Supporters say it involves existing stockpiles with no injury to animals. Most of the world's rhinos live in South Africa. The Northeast U.S. is bracing for a late winter snowstorm that could bring blizzard conditions to the New York area by Tuesday morning. Up to 45 centimeters of snow is in the forecast for some areas, with wind gusts of up to 80 kilometers per hour. Joachim Jensen of Stormar Dragons ended what is believed to have been the longest ice hockey game ever recorded, scoring in the eighth overtime in the Norwegian League playoff Sunday to defeat the Sparta Warriors 2-1. The game began 8 1/2 hours earlier with 217 minutes and 14 seconds of regulation play. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, March 13th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A candidate in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite a Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting.
I'm not interested in any financial remuneration that comes with being government. I truly want to serve to change our country. And the most impactful way to change our country, to touch all 4.2 million people, is through the presidency.
Alexander Cummings is a presidential candidate for the Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. A female peace activist says Burundian women who bear the brunt of the country's conflict should have a role in conflict resolution. And that March is National Dialogue Month in South Sudan, but the government has set conditions for others to participate.
As long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. A World Bank official will discuss boosting infrastructure development in Africa, and Somalis in Kenya fight stereotypes through film. Those stories for Samson Omale Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One of the candidates in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite a Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting. The court ruled earlier this month that a code of conduct for public officials was constitutional. The code requires certain government officials seeking to run for elected offices to resign their posts 2 years before election and for others 3 years before. Alexander Cummings, presidential candidate for the Alternative National Congress Party, was appointed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to serve on the board of directors of the Booker Washington Institute, Liberia's first vocational school. He says while he respects the court's ruling, it does not affect his candidacy.
The Superior Court in our country has ruled, and as a person and as a country that respects the rule of law, we have to abide by the ruling of our Supreme Court. And so while I know there's some debate as to the rationale for the court in the first place, should we be barring anybody from running for elective office, and should we let the Liberian people through their vote make that decision? That debate exists. The fact is the court has ruled. And I think we should respect the ruling of the court because they are the final arbiter of these kinds of decisions.
There's a talk that that ruling affects your chances of running for president. Is that how you see it?
No, it does not. And we have checked every which way. I don't believe we're covered or barred in any way. You know, my aspiration was known. It was no secret when I was asked to serve on the BWI board. I made my aspirations known. It was public. I was going around on my familiarization tour. So there was no ambivalence about my intentions when I did that. And I am supporting BWI because I believe in vocational education. Because BWI was, and I believe still is, the premier vocational education institution in our country. And so my willingness to serve was pure in that regard. And again, my aspiration.
Not for the financial benefit.
There's no financial benefit. It is not a paying role. It's not a job. I don't go to work. Unfortunately, I've not been to any board meetings because I haven't had the time to do that. In fact, I've financially contributed to PWI by procuring a 350 kV generator for the school, a quite expensive generator. So no remuneration.
Mr. Cummings, is there a remedy? I mean, there's some people who say the court has ruled, as you just said. You say it does not impact you, is that right?
It does not impact.
So you intend to
run. So there's no action. Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to ask you, first of all, people see you as an outsider. So what do you think? What are your chances of winning an election in Liberia?
I think my chances are very good. I think being an outsider is actually a positive. And we're viewing it that way, and we're leveraging it that way. And I think more and more Liberians are beginning to see us that way. We are untarnished by any of the challenges of our recent history, by war, by corruption, by any scandals, or any of those things. And so as a result, we offer a fresh perspective, a fresh face, new ideas, a different choice, an alternative choice.
Just briefly define for me your own mission. What's the reason for which you are running?
I believe I've been very blessed in life. First of all, blessed to be a Liberian, a very proud Liberian, blessed with lots of experiences, good family, and I feel an intense obligation to give back to the country of my birth, the country that made me who I am. And so I'm running to serve the Liberian people, to bring the experiences I've been blessed to have.
If I'm not mistaken, I think about 21, 22 candidates. Do you see yourself pairing at some point with some other political parties?
I think coalitions make sense, and we are actively in conversations with other political parties about coalitions. I think that's something that should happen, needs to happen. And so we're open to conversations to coalesce. I'm not interested in being the vice president of Liberia. My aspiration is to be president of Liberia. And I don't say that in any arrogant fashion. I don't say that with any disrespect to the role of vice president. But if you understand what I'm trying to do, why I'm doing it, you'll understand why it's important that I believe I want to lead the country, to work with the Liberian people to set the agenda, to begin the transformation process. I'm not interested in being government just to be in government. I'm not interested in the trappings that come with being government. I'm not interested in any financial remuneration that comes with being government. I truly want to serve to change our country. And the most impactful way to change our country, to touch all 4.2 million people, is through the presidency.
Alexander Cummings is presidential candidate of the Alternative National Congress Party of Liberia. He spoke with me here in Washington, D.C. A female peace activist says Burundian women who bear the brunt of the country's conflict should have a role in resolving the conflict. Karine Kanessa, spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security of Burundi, was denied permission to speak at the United Nations last week. She says that she was informed later that Russia had exercised its veto power over her speech. Kanessa says Burundian women have the legal right to participate in any situation leading to the peaceful resolution of the conflict, including peace negotiations.
First of all, what happened is that I was officially invited by the United Kingdom mission to the United Nations, who was presiding the Security Council for the month of March. And at the last minute, I was informed that the Russian mission had basically exercised its right to veto my speech at the Security Council. I was inside the room. I mean, I was inside. I listened to all the speeches, and what I did was to record my presentation outside of the Security Council, and my speech was delivered to the members of the Security Council and distributed actually more widely than it would have been had I been allowed to address the Security Council itself.
Why do you suppose that happened with the Russians? What's their role? Do they have any part in what's happening in Burundi?
I wouldn't be able to respond to that. I think you have an element of international politics in there. Like in any situation, I think you always have competing interests and competing powers at play, even on very simple matters, like the voice of the civil society being allowed to speak to very important issues pertaining to their own countries. And then you have, obviously, in any protracted conflict like the one in Burundi, you tend to see irresponsible, negative alliances between the regime and other powers. So it could be either one or both of those situations at play.
I do follow what's happening in Burundi a lot, but I don't hear a lot about what women are doing. What's the role of women in Burundi, like your organization? What role are you playing, if at all, in what's going on, say negotiations and all that?
I think women have a multifaceted role to play. I think women, first of all, are the victims of conflicts like the one we see occurring in Burundi. Women are the victims, but at the same time, they are also the ones who will be picking up the pieces and participating in the reconstruction of the country. Let's remember what happened in the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda or elsewhere. You will always see, because men go to war, men will be the ones fighting in the battlefield. You will see women literally, on one hand, they'll be the ones burying their husbands and their brothers and their sons. And on the other hand, they will have to learn very quickly to address different situations in their country. So we do have a very important role. Women, I think, throughout the history of the world, especially in Africa, women have been the advisors of kings, and they've been queens. So we have that in us, I think, historically speaking. And then today, thanks to different actions, advocacy actions from different organizations, we do have a resolution 1325, which was adopted by the United Nations. So we have the right. I think we've passed the de facto type of position we used to be in, and now we do have actually the legal right to participate in any situation leading to the peaceful resolution of these conflicts, including peace negotiations.
Karen Kanessa is the spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security in Burundi. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Today is Monday, March 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. This month is National Dialogue Month in South Sudan, but the government has set preconditions for the participation of the armed opposition and people in opposition-held areas of the country. Government spokesman Michael McQuay says people who took up arms and civilians living in rebel-held areas must first denounce violence before they are allowed to participate in the dialogue, which is slated to begin later this month. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Information Minister Michael McQuay told reporters in Juba that all armed opposition groups trying to overthrow President Salva Kiir's government will not be allowed to take part in the initiative Mr. Kiir announced in December.
As long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue, because originally they don't accept whatever is done by the government. These are the people who are demanding that this government must go. These are the people who are saying this government must be taken over and South Sudan must be turned into a protectorate.
McQuay says the purpose of the national dialogue is to identify issues affecting the country and come up with amicable solutions. He says the national dialogue will be implemented in a bottom-up approach, meaning it will start from the grassroots level. He says the government will pursue an armed group if it continues to fight the Kiir administration.
These people, if they don't accept to come and sit and denounce violence, then definitely we will fight. And if they accept to denounce violence, put down their arms and denounce violence, we'll be ready to sit with them on the table, dialogue as South Sudanese, so that we resolve our problems.
The international community, local activists and opposition politicians have been calling on the government to make the national dialogue inclusive. Otherwise, they say it is nothing more than a monologue. Asked how the government will make the process inclusive when it has set preconditions, McQuay had this to say.
Yes, it shall be inclusive, but this is how we see the inclusivity. Inclusivity does not mean bringing in anybody who is anti-South Sudanese, somebody who is anti-peace, somebody who is anti-everything.
Asked whether the process will succeed if it's spearheaded by President Kiir, who some say is a big part of the problem, McQuay says the president has a right to lead the national dialogue as the legitimately elected head of the country. He dismisses concerns that the dialogue will not succeed so long as it is headed by Mr. Kiir.
What is wrong with the government facilitating such a process? Since the initiative came from it, it has to facilitate it and leave the rest of the work for these bodies to do it. So there is no way whereby you can say this should be spearheaded by neutrals.
McQuay describes the national dialogue as a continuation of the implementation of the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan. Critics say the 2015 peace deal is a failure as both sides violated the agreement within days of being signed. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
The executive director of the World Bank Group One constituency, Andrew Vumme, says the International Development Association has received $75 billion for boosting various projects in Africa and other parts of the world. Vumme said part of this amount, $45 billion, will be set aside for African nations. Vumme, who is a Zimbabwean, says the amount is aimed at boosting infrastructure, agriculture, and mining.
Well, since I started my assignment in November, I think I can say I'm well settled, and we are on our way to implement my agenda. And really, one of my key objectives was to raise resources for the countries I represent. And I want to say that we have just been successful in terms of our IDA 18 replenishment, where we have raised over $75 billion for IDA poor countries. And of that, about $45 billion is going to come to Africa. So this, for me, is a huge success during my first 3 months of the term.
Mr. Vumbe, how big is your constituency and which countries in Africa fall under it?
I have 22 countries in my constituency, ranging from Botswana, Burundi, Lesotho, Swaziland, Namibia, and also Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. Up north, you go to Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, and then on the other side, I've got the Gambia, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. So it's quite a huge and varied composition of countries.
What issues would you like to address during your tenure?
One of the key issues we want to address, which is a huge challenge, is on the infrastructure. I think the issue of energy is very important for my constituents. Without energy, we cannot develop. So even the transformation we are talking about, without energy, we cannot move forward. So that's one area. Infrastructure development is going to be very key. The second area we feel is agriculture and agribusiness, because our countries have been exporting raw materials, commodities, and other mineral commodities. But now what we want is to move away and add value to this. So for agriculture, it's going to be important for us to have agribusiness value chains, and also in the mining sector. So those are two areas which are going to be very important. Besides that, also on the social sector, we need to look at education and also issues relating to health. I think those are some of the areas we want to focus on.
Narrowing down on Zimbabwe, you being a Zimbabwean yourself, what are your plans for this year for Zimbabwe?
Well, as you are aware, Zimbabwe has got a huge debt overhang, and also we have got arrears to the World Bank and to the African Development Bank. And one of our priorities is to normalize the relations between Zimbabwe and the IMF, World Bank, and the African Development Bank. As you might be aware, we have cleared the arrears at the IMF. Now we are working towards clearing the arrears with the World Bank and the African Development Bank. This is our priority programming this year.
Andrew Vume is executive director of the World Bank Group 1 constituency. He was speaking with reporter Marvelous Nyahuye of VOA Studio 7 program for Zimbabwe. You've heard of Hollywood, Bollywood, and Nollywood, but have you heard of Islewood? Islewood is the primarily Somali district of Nairobi, known to some as Little Mogadishu. A group of young people there has been making films to counter stereotypes and radicalization. Rael Ombuo has the story from Nairobi.
Very good. Okay. This is Islewood. Actors are working on a scene for the group's next movie. They have also produced a TV series, several documentaries, and two feature films, including Lanners. This film tells the story of a young man who joins a criminal gang and sees his life spiral downwards. He ends up filled with regrets. The Isili part of Nairobi is home to many Somalis. As Al-Shabaab attacks spread to Kenya, Isili became the target of regular police raids. Isili residents experience discrimination and isolation.
We sent the Kenyan Defense Force to Somalia, and politicians trying to disseminate a lot of hate speech, trying to divide for the community. So we came out and say, okay, let's use audiovisual as platform to tell our true story.
Borhan Iman founded Isiliwood in 2011, the same year Kenya sent its first troop to Somalia. The films show the diversity of the Isili area. The goal is to change people's impression of the Somali community in Kenya and guide local youth, says trainer Abdi Hakim Bare Hassan.
You know, we are living in a time that there are a lot of problems that are facing the youth. Radicalization, drug abuse, crime, such things. So what we do is that we train them so that they can apply what we taught them here in the market, so they at least get busy.
Isiliwood does not shy away from sensitive topics. Their next film tackles the issue of domestic violence. Hassan Rizak always wanted to be an actor. He left his Somali hometown of Kismayo as a child.
I started educating myself whether it's going to primary, secondary, then college. And what I used to like mostly, to be an actor. Then before I joined Islewood, and there was no company which is around in Somali community or in Isli.
Now 6 years into the project, Islewood continues to find inspiration on these city streets. Rael Ombuo for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin from Zambia, where the final of the 2017 Under 20 African Cup of Nations was played on Sunday. Host the Junior Chipolopolo of Zambia became champions of the 2017 Under 20 African Cup of Nations after they defeated Senegal 2-0 in the final on Sunday. It was Zambia's first appearance in the Under 20 AFCON final, while it was back-to-back final defeats for Senegal following their 1-0 loss to the Flying Eagles of Nigeria in the 2015 edition, which they hosted. I spoke with an excited Bestin Chambeshi, head coach of the young Chipolopolo of Zambia, on the secret behind their success.
Yeah, I feel great, and it has been it's nice to win the AFCON. Yeah, I'm very happy to achieve this trophy.
Coach, what was the secret behind your success at the African Cup of Nations for Under 20?
No, it's about the preparation. At least we had a good preparation. You know, we went to Spain. We had to spend 10 days in Spain, and the boys trained very well. We had the nice facilities in Spain. And we are happy with the sponsorship we are getting from the government. They really helped us to prepare very well for the tournament.
Early on Sunday, Guinea defeated the Amajita of South Africa 1-0 to finish third and to win the bronze medal. Both Guinea and South Africa, alongside the 2017 AFCON Under 20 finalists Zambia and Senegal, will represent Africa at this year's FIFA Under 20 World Cup in South Korea. Now to the CAF Champions League, where several matches were played at the weekend in the first leg round of 32 games. Egyptian giants Zamalek fought their way to an epic 4-1 win over Enugu Rangers of Nigeria, while another Nigerian side, Rivers United, cruised to a 3-0 win over Sudanese club El Merik at the Yakubu Gowon Stadium in Port Harcourt. Coach of Nigeria's Rivers United, Stanley Iguma, said the win is a good cushion for them ahead of their second leg game.
I think it wasn't a bad one for us. We take it gradually. The most important thing is that we're able to win today.
Kelechi Osunwa of El Merik of Sudan blamed their loss to fatigue.
All the players are all tired because of the past month we're playing like every 3 days. Playing the Arab Champions League, we're playing the league, and we're playing the African Champions League as well. We just had 8 games this month, so I think all the players are fatigued.
Elsewhere, Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique managed a 2-0 win over Barak Young Controllers FC of Liberia. My colleague James Botti spoke with coach Cooper Sana of the Barak Young Controllers, who says despite their loss in the first leg, he's looking forward to the second leg in Monrovia.
Preliminary round for the group stage, the last stage for the preliminary round to qualify us for the group stage. Sunday will be the return leg in Liberia, specifically in Monrovia.
Should we expect that your team is going to put up a very good fight?
Yeah, we are optimistic with the level of support we've been getting from our management and our own player interaction with the enthusiasm. We are optimistic of winning home, not only winning, but qualifying to the group stage.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports for this Monday morning. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. One of the candidates in this year's Liberia presidential election says he's staying in the race despite a Supreme Court ruling that some say bars him and other candidates from contesting. Alexander Kamis says while he respects the court's ruling, it does not impact his candidacy. And that's it for this Monday, March 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson Omale, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, join host Lenore Modu, reassessing your health stress in 2017 with Ken Red Cross, internal medicine and concierge doctor. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.